Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness.
Madness. This is madness.
We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on three occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the neck to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say it's so what?
The police in riot gear with Trump. I am ashamed to call myself a European.
Recognition of Guaido.
Unelected gobshite is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite, so I would reprimand you over that.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to another episode of I for C podcast with Daly, Wallace and O'Riordan. I think we're breaching around the 100th episode, which we have to do. We have to do a big special on that now.
Excellent. Little party, few little gifts for callers in.
It's not 100 yet, though, is it?
No, nearly.
No, we're at 92.
Nearly. Okay, right, we'll get
now, just for the record, as someone got on to me and said that new Cork girl, that sounds lovely. Tell her she needs to raise her voice a bit more. She's a bit quiet.
Good advice.
That's what a fella said to me.
Did he?
We're a fella from Wexford.
I know who that is.
Called
Michael Freeman.
Michael Freeman. No, and Michael.
Nick's biggest
Michael,
fan.
No, no, that's not quite true now. But no, myself and Michael get on well. And but no, Michael, it'd be sharp.
Well, take that on board. But this week we're coming to you live from Strasbourg at the end of another busy plenary session. There's been some interesting debates and votes this week to discuss. The second plenary since the Russian war in Ukraine. So, Mick, can you speak about some of the consequences for the EU that have been discussed this week?
Well, I suppose there was four debates on Ukraine this week, at least four. Mm. One of them was the social and economic consequences for the EU that arise from the war in Ukraine. And I was just pointing out that the EU, Ukraine itself, obviously, the EU and the Global South are the biggest losers in the war. The impact on fuel, oil, energy and agriculture prices and declining supplies of food, especially for people in the Global South, means many countries will probably be struggling to pay their foreign debts because an awful lot of these countries have huge foreign debts and it's going to put them under terrible pressure. And the euro itself is been undermined, whether people like to admit it or not. And we're risking an EU-wide recession with the sanctions that we're imposing, which are going to have less impact on the Russian government and our potential to stop the war than they'll have on our own European citizens. But it was actually interesting that the US Treasury Secretary, her name is Janet Yellen, I think, she made a speech earlier about 2 weeks ago, and she outlined how the US will use the IMF to provide conditional assistance to struggling states that are friendly to US geostrategic interests.
Friends like that,
but they'll be threatening sanctions against any country that even looks pleasantly at Russia or has anything to do with them. Now, it was great that Pope Francis came out and apportioned some blame on NATO for the war starting. And he questioned the wisdom of supplying arms to Ukraine, which myself and Claire have been doing from the start of the war. So I'm not sure if there's two-page spreads been done in the Irish papers condemning Pope Francis yet. Maybe I haven't been following them, but maybe there is. But Pope Francis was addressing the fact that NATO are making no secret of the fact that while they're saying that they won't get directly involved, they're prepared to fuel the war for as long as it takes. And that's scary. And, I mean, it is involvement. If you're helping to fill the place with arms and make sure the war stays going, oblivious to the amount of Ukrainians that will die because of your attitude, then that is really scary.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've touched on a lot of things there. And for me, the Pope's statement was really strong. I mean, he's already from the very beginning been very forthright in his condemnation of the war, but very balanced on the need for peace and you know, has tried and put out the call for Putin to meet him. I think Putin should do that. It would be a great step forward. But the scary thing about the response is that, and you know, we joke and say, is there going to be a two-page spread about it? There hasn't been, as we sit here, a single word in the Irish Times about the Pope's speech, but they managed to do a big, huge spread about his comments on the need to change the way in which bishops were elected. Now, there's something very rotten in the state of Denmark. Everything that the Pope said was exactly like everything that we said. NATO was involved, condemnation of the war, the need for peace, the need to stop arms going in. He even said these arms are being tested in Ukraine. That is why we make them. That's what wars do. He talked about the intervention being the same as in Yemen and Syria and so on, behind the scenes, stirring it up and all of that. And OK, I think the Irish Times would find it hard to call the Pope a Putin puppet, but that may yet come. They may say he's deranged or mad or something. But at the moment, they've chosen absolute silence. And I think that is disgusting. And it just shows their agenda on this, you know, frightening, actually, in some ways, how they're distorting these things.
So the Pope is not an embarrassment yet?
Doesn't seem to be.
Are you not a disgrace?
Yeah, no, they're just going to ignore him. In fairness, as we said about Michael D made points about the need for diplomacy and neutrality. And they just kind of did a little one-liner and then pushed him to the side. There was no double-page spreads on that. And people really need to start questioning this type of propaganda against the time in the last days when we've had the EU, as part of the sanctions, imposing a ban on 3 Russian stations because they say they're authoritarian and they're distorting the news. That's what our media does as well. It's disgusting.
And this kind of brings us into the whole issue with the freedom of the press and the debate about journalism that the Vice President Roberta Metsola was having this week during the plenary session.
Yeah, well, Tuesday was World Press Day, and while the Commission and the Parliament President were going to great lengths to tell us how wonderful everything was and how much they care about real journalism and how much they defend it morning, noon and night, I just read one sentence from President Metsola's opening speech, and she says, "I am proud that this Parliament stands up for what we believe in. I am proud that we match our rhetoric with action today and every day, because a strong democracy needs a strong press. And we know that there can be no democracy without freedom of the press."
Groan.
She's right in the sense that there can be no democracy without freedom of the press, but we don't have freedom of the press. We have control of it by monopolies, by people with a lot of money. And we see right across Europe, and including in Ireland, we have people who are able to use their control of the print media or of the state-affiliated RTE to propagate their message. And as I've said in response to the criticism that we got when we voted against the censorship of Russia Today, and it was put to me that, but these are putting out propaganda. Yeah, so that's what everyone else does too. RTE put out propaganda every day. The Irish Times put out propaganda every day. The Irish Independent, the Irish Examiner, Cork Examiner, the Irish Examiner. I mean, in all fairness, I mean, you could take it. You want an awful lot of salt to be thrown on most things they're saying.
It's so arrogant as well. Like this idea that there's one truth or there can only be one opinion. And it's the same arrogance that we see in the sanctions debate, because we're going to cripple the Russians now. We've stopped in terms of oil. They don't seem to realise that we live in a world. There are 195 countries in that world. Only 30 of them are imposing sanctions on Russia. So if the EU wants to put itself into economic destitution in a so-called war to damage Russia, there's 165 other countries out there who are doing business with Russia and who will happily buy their gas. So what Ukrainians are you saving? You're sacrificing the lives of working people and unemployed people all across Europe, the poor and the vulnerable, for a war they never started by continuing on. It's disgusting. And if we had a critical press, they'd be making those points. But of course, both of us got the chance to say not a mention of Julian Assange. How sick that we can never get Julian's name mentioned, particularly against the backdrop of a war at the moment when he was the journalist who exposed the most about the war crimes in the US, and they still didn't mention him on World Press Day either.
Yeah, I mean, the most renowned and significant journalist for the last decade, probably of our generation, Julian Assange, doesn't merit a mention from the European Parliament. Mm. I mean, it'd make you sick. Mm. And it just exposes the hypocrisy that they engage in. And Kate, you mentioned authoritarianism. And they claim that, oh, we're opposing authoritarianism. Now, we're banning media outlets, left, right and centre. So we're saying, oh, you can't say that because we disagree with you. That's propaganda.
Yeah,
well, I mean, why don't you let the people listen to both sides of the propaganda? Let them listen to the Russians, let them listen to the Chinese and everyone else, and listen to the Irish and the English. Did you see where the English have banned Brian MacDonald, an Irish guy?
Go away.
I swear to God. Yeah.
Well, no, that's where it's going. I mean, it's only a matter of time.
Brian MacDonald, right, a real good journalist, and he's disappeared off Twitter. And you know, I mean, I'd say he got into trouble in Russia too. Right. And we have no problem admitting that the Russians are clamping down on media. But so are the Europeans.
Absolutely.
Like, you're sick.
Yeah.
It's interesting how, like, there's, when you talk about media and media censorship, there's like a consensus with American media and how, like, American corporate media is just biased and propaganda. But how, like, how is that a completely separate entity to Europe, and how it's sort of corporate media is like crossing the Atlantic into Europe, and how, like, different censorship is, like, increasingly happening in European media.
It's terrible the way they sort of classify, oh, well, these are like-minded partners and they have our values. Bit flippin' scary, like, because they were going on about artificial intelligence and surveillance and all that in another debate that we had this week. And of course, the usual, blame the Chinese, blame the Russians. They're the ones who are coming. They're the ones who are monitoring everyone. But in actual fact, the big surveillance scandals have come from the NSA in America and the GCHQ in the UK for tapping into cables, robbing people's data and surveying all of our transactions as well. So it's just a total hypocrisy. If they are our like-minded partners and values, well, then that's frightening too.
And more of our like-minded partners are Israel, who have been persecuting the Palestinians for so many years, and the Saudis and the UAE and Qatar, who have been carrying out a genocide against the people of Yemen.
Mm.
And we're fine with that. Mm. Multiples are dying and in Yemen, over 400,000 at this stage, according to the UN, and almost 16 million driven into extreme poverty, right? But there are the people causing that, and that we're giving arms to. The Americans and the Europeans are supporting the Saudi genocide in Yemen, and the European Parliament doesn't want to talk about
it. Well, sure. I mean, we don't even have to look outside. I mean, we had another discussion this week on the Article 7 proceedings against Poland and Hungary. Now, these are the power that the European unions have in, if you like, trying to make sure that member states adhere to the common rules in the EU institutions. So rule of law, respect for human rights and all of that sort of stuff. And obviously the Poles and the Hungarians have been a bit bold on that front now over the past period. Not that the Commission and that really particularly care, because these proceedings began about 5 years ago or more and absolutely nothing has happened. And of course now, with the war in Ukraine, Poland and Hungary, who were the demons because of their rampant homophobia, their huge problems regarding independence of the judiciary, are now kind of the best boys and girls in class. They're the ones pulling the strings on the border with Ukraine. So these sort of rabid, ultra-right-wing, Eastern European Polish nationalists, their views have become mainstream now in terms of the war, and anti-Russian rhetoric is par for the course now. So actually, the liberal middle in Europe is now aping the extreme that only 3 months ago they were given out about. And I think the debate around Poland and Hungary reflected that, not to mention the fact, as we've pointed out many times, that actually Poland and Hungary, bad and all as they are, do have a point when they say, well, what are you picking on us for when you have massive violations of Islamophobia in France? Now, they wouldn't care about that, obviously, rabid nationalists in Poland. But they are right. There's a hypocrisy there, the clampdown of dissent in Spain with the repression of the Catalans and so on, and other violations in Greek and other places. So the whole thing is a hypocritical, big, fat, mixed up pie. I don't know what it is. It's just a mess.
And you'll remember, I mean, we've been to two trials in Lithuania for Algirdas Paleckis, and we were criticised in the Irish media, believe it or not, for supporting a Russian spy.
Really?
Now, you might find this hard to believe, but the only evidence they have against Algirdas for being a Russian spy, even the judges can't hear it. We have the evidence, but we can't tell you. They cannot even tell the judges.
This is security services.
Yeah. I mean, so it's a state secret, right? It's a state secret, the evidence is, right? And the judges have to, are going to convict Algirdas more than likely.
This week, yeah.
The trial is back down for tomorrow for judgment. And they have, the judges will not even hear or see the so-called evidence. This guy is a journalist, right? And the journalists in Ireland were criticising us for actually supporting a journalist for speaking his mind. And he's getting charged. He's already spent 18 months in prison. He spent nearly 2 years with a shackle on his leg at home after being released. And now he's facing a couple of more years in prison because he said something that the Lithuanian government didn't like. And Lithuania, if people don't realise it, is actually part of the European Union. Where is the rule of law in Lithuania? Where is the rule of law and the consistency of rule of law in Europe when this can happen in a member state of the European Union? It is absolutely disgraceful.
And we talk about judicial independence in Poland. But like you said, Mick, the judges don't hear. But the judges actually asked to see the evidence. So they said, could we see this evidence, please, Secret Service? And they said, well, look, we'll think about it and we'll see. And then they can't. So, no, you can't. So, I mean, you know, what hypocrisy on so many fronts.
It doesn't speak to a fair trial, does it?
Mad.
But relating to the whole judicial branch within the EU, this week in the plenary, there's been much debate about EU elections and the election contradictions. Could you speak a bit about that?
Oh, God, it's such a bore in some ways. Like, they all get, you know, absolutely ecstatic about this idea, the conference on the future of Europe. And this was supposed to be the EU's response to the democratic deficit that we have. And the points we were making was, well, we certainly do have a democratic deficit. I mean, in about 7 or 8 member states, there's less than 30% of people voting in European elections. There's an enormous disconnect between the citizens of Europe and the EU institutions. And most of the people around here are in a total bubble, in denial regarding the disconnect between the lives of European citizens and the decisions that are made here. And of course, we have the complete sham of a parliament here. So one of the measures they were looking at, which we call technical fixes. Oh, how do we get people more interested in the European Union? Let's make the voting system different. Let's do transnational lists so you can vote for everybody in Europe. And the people should be able to vote for Ursula von der Leyen. Well, I'm sure a lot of people would love to see have to vote for an end to Ursula von der Leyen. But this isn't the problem at the heart of the EU. It's not going to be fixed by a technical arrangement that you could vote for a German or whatever. It needs radical reform and treaty reform, but not in the way in which they're calling. I mean, the people who participated in this Conference of Europe were people from national governments, national parliaments, and people selected across Europe. But they're already people who are in the bubble. They're not a young fella from Finglas or a migrant from France or something. They're already people who are connected with the EU. So they're just going to reinforce their own nonsense. There is talk about changing the treaties, which we'd be in favour of. The treaty needs to change. We shouldn't be here in Strasbourg. This lunacy of moving everybody again down here, the environmental damage and the cost. But the Parliament should have more powers, of course. But ultimately, we need to tackle neoliberalism at the heart of the EU.
And do you think that this democratic deficit that a lot of people say the same rhetoric about, and do you think that the EU perpetuates it and creates it even more?
Well, I mean, one of the arguments for introducing this kind of a universal vote where people in all 27 countries can vote for any individual from any of the countries. And someone asked me, oh, just, yourself and Claire, he said, should be absolutely fighting for this because you'd be guaranteed to get elected given that we get more positive media coverage across the 26 member states than we do in Ireland. Yeah. But we said, no, this is just another sticking plaster and it's just a papering over the crack that there's a serious lack of democracy in the European Union. But I mean, we both got speaking time on it on Monday night. And I pointed out that there's a huge scarcity of democracy in the member states in the first place, particularly in the countries where there is, from a realistic point of view, there is no real local government. And in Ireland, we have no local government. We have poorly funded local administration, but we have no local government. And if you have no local government, it is near impossible for the citizens to have a say in how their society is organised. Now, it was being debated in the plenary and they were saying, democracy is being able to vote every 5 years. And if you can vote twice, well, that's even more democracy. Sorry now. No, that's not democracy. Democracy is where you can actually have a say in how your society is organised, not in how you can vote. As Claire pointed out, in some of the countries, 2/3 of the people are not even voting. So it's an absolute sham, right? Now, if you think it's bad in the member states where there is a scarcity of democracy and the people with the most money can more often than not determine who gets elected. And that's why we have so much right-wing governments all across Europe, including Ireland. Irish state is over 100 years old. We've never had a government that wasn't right-wing. And I mean, so what are the media doing? Have they any responsibility in that? But to go back to the European Union, as bad as it is at the member states, I would say there's more democracy at play in Ireland than there is in the European Union. Because I said, is it pretending that we have democracy here in the European Parliament? Hold on a minute. I said, we're the only ones. We have three institutions in Europe. We have the Parliament, we have the Council, and we have the Commission. The Parliament are elected by the people, but we cannot initiate legislation. It's, the truth be told, it's a talking shop, right? The Council have more power than us, and their meetings are held in secret. The Commission have more power than us, and they're not elected by the people. So the one body of the three that's elected by the people has the least power. There is no democracy in the European Union institutions.
So, and no scrutiny of what goes on, because we voted on all of the discharge files and that as well. And as the Transnational Institute pointed out in a brilliant paper that they had published again this week, these are the people who highlight about arms expenditure and all the rest, that 53.9 billion is being spent by the European Union on security. And in this week, when we saw Leggeri, the head of the Frontex, the European Coast Guard, having to resign, which was great because there's been a fraud investigation into them. We've covered on the podcast before about the violation of fundamental rights on Europe's borders with the complicity and involvement of Frontex, which Leggeri was well aware of. So we welcome the fact that he has resigned, but we do want more, better accountability and scrutiny. It's one of the biggest recipients of EU funds, and the securitisation of our borders has got so much money, as well as obviously the accelerating billions going into militarism, but no scrutiny or accountability of that either, you know.
On that subject, we had some speaking time on Monday as well on the militarisation of Europe, and it's just been released that global military expenditure in 2021, last year, increased to a point where it reached $2.1 trillion, the highest global annual spend on record. Now, after the Cold War ended, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, there was a year-on-year drop in global arms sales in the post-Cold War period, and up until 2001. And after 9/11 in 2001, the Americans increased it dramatically, and it reversed the trend that had been in place. And of course, it became an absolute bonanza for the global arms industry ever since. But while we know that global warming and climate systems breakdown are resulting in mass displacement, food shortages for many in the global south, starvation and instability, in response, our leaders have ignored mitigating global warming and instead are spending incredible amount of resources on military hardware. And we've the Irish government now actually advocating that we spend more on military. I mean, and all this does is, I mean, we have these people, our so-called leaders, stoking conflicts in different parts of the world and further threatening life on Earth. I mean, it's never been so obvious that there's no genuine democracy under monopoly capitalism. It's just all about the consolidation of the oligarchs.
Yeah, and I mean, if you think about it, it is joining the dots we made last week about the corporate capture here by lobbyists, because anybody with a brain in their head would sort of say, huge amount of money being spent on military, never equal before, and yet the world is more unsafe than it ever was. Maybe we're doing something wrong here. Maybe we should change tack, and that the answer isn't more militarism, it's actually demilitarism, which of course it is. But the only people who lose out in that are the shareholders of the big military-industrial complex. They're the ones who have the ear of the EU institutions, and it's their agenda that's been furthered against the wishes of ordinary people. And I think that was one of the sort of more positive aspects in the discussion that we had here, was the resolution on the impact of the war on women and children who are disproportionately affected by it. We see most of the people crossing over the border and leaving their homes. 90% of them are women. They're much more prey to sexual violence. Traffickers are around. There's problems with the vetting of transport providers, of, you know, homes or residential units where these women are having to flee from. All wars bring increased sexual violence, so the whole area of reproductive rights and women's bodily autonomy comes into it. So the motions were quite good in dealing with that, in the need to provide support for women in relation to sexual violence, in terms of providing access to contraception and abortion care as well. Also care, there are 80,000 women in Ukraine about to give birth, so supporting them as well in this, and the need for member states to provide support. But one of the flaws, I suppose, is we have this temporary protection directive, which has been rightly lifted, allowing Ukrainians to come in and live and work and get social benefits. But 8 of the member states have excluded people who had a residency in Ukraine or were third country nationals in Ukraine, like asylum seekers or whatever. They've excluded them from that directive. So even though they were in Ukraine, 8 of the countries said, no. Even though you're fleeing, which in a place that was your home, you're not crossing. So the extra trauma on those women and children is disgusting. And yet they still go on about European values.
I know, it's terrible. I mean, and as you said, the report does capture the extent of the challenges faced by women and children either trapped or fleeing the war zone in Ukraine. And it is horrific. But I mean, we would be hoping that people would start to realise just how horrible all war is. And it should be pointed out that in every war, both sides engage in terrible brutality and horror against women and children. So it's all the more necessary that we fight for peace. But has there ever in your lifetime been such a pushback against the vice for peace, for the anti-war vice? Because I haven't seen it so strong before, especially from mainstream media. We're being ridiculed for being pro-peace and being anti-war. But we have to, if you just think about the plight of women and children in Ukraine today, would you not start to consider the fight, as the Pope did, start questioning the wisdom of sending more and more arms into Ukraine, escalating the war, causing more Ukrainians to die? But we should also stop executing the war on Yemen. And we should stop using sanctions as a weapon of war in countries like Syria and Afghanistan, Iran, Venezuela and Yemen, and anywhere else where these, I mean, sanctions are being used as a brutal weapon, and they're causing people to die of hunger. And we have no problem with it. I mean, the truth is, Fortress Europe has to end. And we should extend the compassion that we rightly gave the Ukrainian women and children to all refugees and internally displaced people, because selective humanity isn't humanity at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. And on that note, I think we call it a wrap from Strasbourg.
And Kate has already run for the train, so she's left us.
Had to leave us. But yeah, no, look, it, I mean, you're totally right. The Voices for Peace are being ridiculed, demonised as Putin puppets. Obviously, I was speculating whether they'd go there with the Pope, but clearly not. He's just been sidelined now. It's delegitimising a different view. And for all of those so-called liberals and Democrats out there who are fanning the hatred that's out there. I mean, there's some really scary developments of anti-Russian sentiment. We've had the Latvian Prime Minister basically saying all Russians are violent, talking about nearly expelling all Russians, stopping Russian education. We've seen graveyards being desecrated, neo-Nazi re-emergences and confidence in Bulgaria and in other countries. The Europe is hurtling into a very scary place, and the MEPs and the EU institutions cannot get enough of it except to keep us on that track, on the road to hell. Unreal.
I never thought I would see the day when the European Union, which was formed as a peace project, is now promoting war and is rehabilitating Nazi elements in Europe.
All over the place. It's
frightening times.
And we're going to see an escalation on Monday. So the 9th of May is what's known as Victory Day. It's a huge day in Russia because that was celebrating and marking the fact that the Red Army defeated Nazism in World War II. And they did. And let's remember that the Russians lost 20 million, the Soviet Union, which involves actually Ukrainians, Georgians and so many others in that war. They're marking that day in their victory over Nazism. But Europe is involved in a project of actually rewriting history, glorifying Nazis and demonising, taking down statues of people who happen to come from Russia or the former Soviet Union in the Latvia and Lithuania and so on because of the war, and basically at the same time letting neo-Nazis organise. Really scary.
We are living in mad times.
Anyway, next week, au revoir from Strasbourg.
Back in Brussels next week. Yeah. All the best. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.